You're listening to Catholic Chicago Week in Review on Relevant Radio 950 AM and 930 AM. During the next hour, the Archdiocese of Chicago brings you conversation about the people, events, and issues that touch our lives. Welcome to Catholic Chicago Week in Review.
Good morning. I'm Jim Dish with the Archdiocese of Chicago's Radio TV office, joining you on Relevant Radio 950 and 930 AM. Every Saturday morning, we bring you highlights of our Catholic Chicago radio programs that air throughout the week. We have several interesting highlights to share, beginning with our Catholic Conference of Illinois program, hosted by its executive director, Bob Gilligan. Bob had a conversation with Kathleen Gallagher of the New York State Catholic Conference about fallout from that state's passage of extreme abortion legislation.
Kathy, I think you know we've been dealing with a bill similar to what you had to deal with in New York a couple, I think it was last year. And so far, we've been able to hold this off, but we don't know. We have about 2 months to go in our legislative session, and we're cautiously optimistic. But I have to say that I think part of the reason we have been the experience, the success that we have, is just because of the reaction that what happened out in New York. I think people were really clued into what happened, and when they saw something similar, not exactly what happened in New York, wow, that really had people's attention. Tell us a little bit about your bill, and how did that pass in New York?
Well, our bill was called the Reproductive Health Act.
Same here.
It was first introduced, believe it or not, 12 years ago.
Okay.
So it was a 12-year battle. It was first introduced by our governor, Spitzer. Some people might not remember him.
I remember him well.
Kind of a blip. So we fought it tooth and nail for 12 years. 2013 is the most memorable year because that year Governor Andrew Cuomo wrapped it up in what he called a 10-point women's equality package. And all the other items in that package were things we liked, you know, like cracking down on domestic abusers and human trafficking, et cetera. But the real reason for that package was to slip through this new abortion law. So we fought it then. We won. What changed things this year was the 2018 elections when our state Senate flipped. So our entire legislature and executive mansion now is controlled by the Democrats.
That count,
And, Bob, I don't know why. I really don't. I've been in pro-life activities for 35 years, and I still don't understand why abortion is the litmus test for the Democrats. I don't get it. But that was their number one priority. So our session, our legislative session, started in January, and right out of the gate they said, this is what we're going to do. And we knew they had the votes to do it. But like you said, I think Governor Andrew Cuomo thought that this was going to make him famous, right? He thought this was going to make him the most progressive women's rights leader in the country. And instead, in some miraculous way, it backfired, and people started talking about infanticide and how cruel and expansive this law was and how unnecessary because New York State already led the nation in the number and rate of abortions.
Yeah.
So you're right. People are outraged and offended. We've got counties in New York State passing resolutions calling on the state legislature to repeal this.
Really?
We've got churches, just this weekend, 75 churches in western New York prayed for repentance on Palm Sunday weekend for this act passing. I mean, people are really coming out of the woodwork here to say, this goes too far, this is too much. So that's a good thing.
You know, that is a good thing. That's interesting. I've said from the get-go, I don't know how to even say this diplomatically, but I'm in some ways grateful that New York went first, because once this bill was introed, people were like, it's New York. And it's not really exactly what you did, but it's bad enough. You know, we don't have that provision about the born alive that you did. Although I have to say, the way they crafted ours, it could be arguable whether it's in there or not. But to be fair, I don't think it is. But that's okay. There's plenty in there. There's like 10 provisions, and you know what it is? They just loaded it up with everything they could possibly want.
It's Planned parenthood's wish list.
That's what I've been
really
saying.
It really is.
Exactly. That's exactly what I've been saying. So, you know, and I don't want to get sidetracked on this, but, you know, I think that movie Unplanned is also having an effect. I hear people talking about that now. And, you know, I just pray that maybe, just maybe, this is waking people up. And for the first time in my career, I can say that people are starting to understand what happened. I think we have a long way to go, but lawmakers I'm talking to on the Democratic side, because that's where we're in the same boat you are, the majority's on the Democratic side, and our governor's a Democrat. You ask them, like, what does pro-choice mean? And you focus on that second and third term and what that means.
They
don't have an answer. And it's becoming increasingly obvious to me that the truth that I firmly believe ultimately will win out is starting to rear its head. And I think it's something, once it gets out there, you can't put it back.
I think you're absolutely right. I really think that this is a great educational tool. And I know it's awful and it's horrific what's happened here in New York, but people are starting to understand what Roe versus Wade means.
Exactly.
Like, nobody knew that before, you know?
Right.
And we've been saying it till we're blue in the face, but nobody seemed to get it before. So God is planting seeds all over the place.
I hope so.
And I agree, that movie, the timing of that movie has been providential for us.
Yeah.
Because, again, it's opening people's eyes. So, yeah, that's all good.
Yeah, I saw it over the weekend. I saw it on Friday. And it's one of those movies that stays with you. It's not something... There's some scenes in there that you just don't forget. And I have to say, even myself, I mean, I'm, you know, I know this issue from a political perspective, and I can't relate to parts of the issue. But when you see, you know, the pain that is experienced from what happens in abortion, it stays with you. And also, I'll say, you know, as my wife and I were talking afterwards, it's interesting on my personal perspective is that the most emotional aspect of that movie that I saw was when they showed the people praying outside the clinic, especially the woman. I could relate to that. I don't know why. It's really weird. That was a very emotional moment. And I think it shows the love and compassion that people truly have for people who are in need. And that's really what we're trying to get at and you know, struggling to do so. But I think, like I said, ultimately the truth will win out.
Yes. I don't know whether it's the movie or the New York abortion law, but our local 40 Days for Life campaigns here in New York State have doubled in numbers.
Yep, great.
So, again, God is planting seeds, so that's all good.
Yeah. Where do you go from here? I know New York is your process is somewhat different than ours, and talking to your folks and your director out there, I know that it seems like they almost sort of agree on what bills are going to get heard first, and then they once they agree to that, they're almost assured of passage. Is there anything you can do to amend some of these provisions, or is that just not going to happen until there's electoral changes?
Yeah, being realistic, that is not going to happen anytime in the near future. I think one of the things we have to do with Catholics is help persuade them that their faith and their pro-life beliefs have to be linked with their politics.
Yeah.
People don't get that. They compartmentalize their life and they say, my faith is here, my family's here, my job is here, and my politics is here. No. We carry our faith and Christ with us everywhere, even into the voting booth. So I think we have to make, you know, faithful citizenship and the moral responsibility of Catholics to link their faith and their politics together. That's got to be a priority. People have to hold these legislators accountable for what happened here in New York State.
I suppose New York, I was born in New York, and all the major states are like this, is that where we are the weakest is in the city of Chicago. And the city of Chicago, it's a fact, is controlled by the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm.
Both our municipal elections and our state reps and senators, except for one, they're all Democrats. And it does bother me, especially when I see in the Hispanic areas and that are primarily Catholic and most of the, not all the city, but most of the city, we're still the majority of the faith is Catholic in Chicago. how we consistently vote for people that, when it comes to the abortion issue, they just leave that issue aside and they just don't address it. I don't understand why that consistently happens in the major cities.
Yeah, I don't either. You know, I have to say we had 9 courageous Democrats in our state legislature that voted no our abortion law. 2 of them have already heard that they're going to be primaried by other Democrats because they're traitors.
Yep.
That's how much of a litmus test it is.
Yeah.
You know, so that's just so sad. I mean, I was once a Democrat. You know?
Yeah.
It's the party of the vulnerable, isn't it? We're supposed to stand up for the oppressed and the vulnerable.
Yeah, except for when it comes to the unborn. But I think to the degree, Kathy, we keep driving that point home about what does the term pro-choice mean? And I try to press people to have them define it to me. And you know what? They can't do it.
Yeah.
They can never do it.
You're right.
They can't.
We've also started working with Students for Life, Students
group.
For Life of America. They are really unafraid to go on college campuses and into high schools and ask their peers questions. Like, do you know what this new abortion law does in New York State? You know, just to start a dialogue and a conversation, because that's how we're going to change the culture. We just have to have peaceful, compassionate, loving conversations with people.
I agree. And we're still 2 months out. So far, we've held the bill off. I'm concerned about the next month. The final month of the session is when, as you know, crazy things can happen. I fear for, amendments that water it down. But still, the main thing that the Catholic Conference has harped on is what our bill does. It creates a fundamental right to abortion in Illinois state law. And we keep talking about that and keep talking about that, because our point is that is more extreme than Roe v. Wade. I mean,
absolutely. That's what happened in New York. It made abortion a fundamental right. And I think that the consequences of that are unknown at this time, really scary, because, you know, it says that the state of New York cannot discriminate against that fundamental right. So if a doctor wants to get his medical license from our state board of health, can the state say no if it's a pro-life doctor because you'd be discriminating against a fundamental right?
Yeah.
Can the state give any money at all to life-affirming maternity programs because, hey, those programs are discriminating against a fundamental right? I mean, I think there's so many unknowns. That's really scary.
And that's exactly what they're doing in our laws. It seems like this is their playbook. They're going to the major states where they have strong political connections, and that's what it is. It comes down to, unfortunately, they are so powerful when it comes to the checkbook and dollars, and they just threaten people, as you indicated. If anybody, I'm sure the tactics are the same in Illinois as they are in New York. And anybody that violates that 100% absolute loyalty to abortion rights is considered a traitor and primaried and thrown out. It's incredible the power they yield. It's
unbelievable.
Yeah.
Let me ask you a quick question. What does your abortion legislation, what would it do to your fetal homicide law?
They did retain that. They made a provision in there that says that if there's still a death of an unborn person, that it still counts as 2 homicides.
Wow.
They kept that.
Wow.
Yeah.
We never had a fetal homicide law in New York. All we had was the crime of abortion. You know, if a domestic abuser throws a pregnant woman down the stairs and kills her baby.
Mm-hmm.
Now we don't even have the crime of abortion. There's no accountability whatsoever.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think they went with the most extreme version they could find in New York. And I think that ours is not as I mean, I don't even want to compare the two, but it does seem that they've taken out some of the more extreme provisions as New York had, but still, nonetheless, ours is, once you get into fundamental rights language, it's bad.
Yeah, yep. I'll be praying for you all in Illinois.
Please, we need it. We need it. We got the goal is May 31st. I'm optimistic, but we're very concerned about the next, 60 days or so.
Controversial legislation was a theme for Bob's program this past Monday. He also talked with Robert McCoppin, a Chicago Tribune reporter who covered efforts to legalize marijuana.
You know, our timing was perfect, right? Your paper came out in an editorial yesterday, so we couldn't have planned this any better. And I think what the Tribune was saying in so many words was take this slow and get it right. Don't rush it, because it seems like it might be rushed a little bit, a lot of it. So, yeah, it's April, what, 15th? Legislature's off for 2 weeks. We're going to come back. Lawmakers will reconvene on April the 30th. Scheduled adjournment day is almost 1 month from that date. It will be on May 31st, I believe. And there's a lot of issues to iron out, or maybe not. It looks like Ms. Steens, the sponsor in the Senate, has said that she's going to, they're going to unveil a proposal when they come back. So what are you thinking? Are they have these issues ironed out yet, or are we still going to have some room for negotiations?
Well, they are trying to iron out all the issues, as many issues as possible beforehand, before they introduce the bill. But the clock is definitely ticking, because they only have the month of May then to pass the legislation this spring if they want to do, which they're trying to do. And there has been a resolution signed on to by 60 members of the House asking to slow down on legalization of marijuana. And so that definitely throws a wrench into the process.
So I know we're all talking about this number of 170 million. I'd be curious to hear if you have any insights. As I do not. And I'm down there all the time. And not that they're going to tell me, because we're opposed to the bill. So we're not really a part of the negotiations. But, you know, I've said this from the get-go, that in issues like this, I've seen this before. Let's say if they are projecting to bring in $100 from the proceeds of recreational marijuana, and that's the projection. But before they do that, they have to make sure that everybody's needs are satisfied who are going to be impacted by this. And that's a lot of folks. You know, the state police need additional money for safety on how they're going to detect people who are under the influence of marijuana. The hospitals are saying, hey, we're going to have more admissions, so we're going to need some revenue to pay for treatment of that. The substance abuse people are saying there's going to be more substance abuse. We need treatment. We need money for that. The list goes on and on and on. And I think you've seen this too, is what happens is that the line of people grows that wants that money. So my $100 now becomes 25, or maybe it becomes 10. It just gets lower and lower. I'm just curious if you have any insights onto can they get to 170 million anymore, or is it been all gobbled up by these various interest groups that have legitimate requests?
Well, yeah, everybody at the table wants a piece of the pie, so it definitely is going to go fast. But I think they can probably actually make, I believe that the $170 million was what was budgeted in the governor's budget proposal, because if they pass this, if they legalize marijuana, it will take until next year sometime probably to go to market. So they'll only get maybe, you know, less than half a year's worth of revenue,
right?
For the first year, because they're in a fiscal year that goes, you know, from mid-year to mid-year. But they can make a lot more money than that, I think, just because Colorado has made like over $200 million in the past year, and Illinois is twice the size of Colorado. So, you know, they might be in line to make half a billion a year. But there are definite costs to this, as you say. I mean, there's going to be more addiction. There's going to be need to be more counseling, preventive education. The police are going to have to. There's no good way right now to test for driving under the influence of marijuana. So they have to train officers on how to recognize the signs of being high while driving. So those are all concerns that will have to be addressed and they'll have to spend money on yet.
One of the outstanding issues, I believe, too, is the issue of, this is for listeners, it's called homegrown. How many plants should an individual be allowed legally to grow in their own home? And I know that I think the governor has come out and said, yes, he supports homegrown. My understanding is the industry writ large I'm not sure if industry is distributors or growers or retailers, but they have objections to that. Is there any, do you have any insights into where that is or where it's going?
Well, only that I know law enforcement is very opposed to homegrown. So the sponsors of the bill have, last I've heard, have said that, maybe that might just be for the medical marijuana patients, which is about, 60,000 people right now, relatively small group of people, although that will expand probably with another bill. There's another bill pending to make the medical marijuana program permanent, and that would add conditions to qualifying conditions, some common things like migraines and chronic pain. But as to the homegrown plants, the police don't like it, so the industry, that takes away from the growers who are trying to, mm-hmm. to sell it. So it looks like that might be limited.
Limited, okay.
And to maybe like five plants for just medical marijuana patients, and everybody else has to buy it from the store.
Got it. And I know the other concern, I hear this and other, there's a lot of concerns, a lot of legitimate concerns too. And I my sense is, even in states where they've had it for a while, there's still some issues out there with various aspects of legalization of marijuana. And one of them is edibles, and how does that marketed to children, and can children, the appearance of marijuana in something that would appeal to children, like, I'm making up stuff, like Rice Krispies and things like that. Are you aware of that's in the bill at all, or is that not been...
Well,
I don't know where that is.
To my understanding, from talking to Heather Sains and Kelly Cassidy, the sponsors, I believe that edibles will be allowed. I mean, they certainly have been under the medical marijuana program, and that includes things like gummy mm-hmm. candies,
right.
and candy
right.
bars, and things that are very appealing, could be very appealing to kids. And Colorado, I recently made a trip out to Colorado.
Oh.
They've had... emergency room visits due to marijuana skyrocket, and they have kids going in there, and also adults who have eaten edibles and nothing happens at first, so they eat more and
right.
then they end up freaking out. So
yeah.
And then going to the hospital because they're freaking out. And physically, marijuana can't kill you, but it can be more than you bargained for. So that is a question that I'm sure will be wrestled with as to what extent you want, this drug in candy that kids might get into.
I know the public opinion polling and where it is. And as you know, the Catholic Conference, we came out early, put out a statement advising lawmakers not to approve this. And
right.
I recognize, too, where the culture is writ large. Is there any aspect of this debate that surprised you a little bit in terms of what we're doing as a society? It just seems like this is going awfully fast. I don't want to prejudice your response. Is there any aspect of the debate that surprised you?
Well, the edibles, I'm surprised that the edibles hasn't been more of an issue because of kids getting into it.
Right.
I understand people don't like smoking. Smoking is not good. The doctors don't like smoking for as a drug delivery system for anything. Having it in candy is another matter. I mean, there's other ways you can do it. You could just have it in drops
right.
if you don't want to smoke it. So
right.
That is one aspect that will have to be addressed. And then, it has been a very fast shift in attitudes publicly over the past few years. Of course, on the other hand, marijuana advocates would say, well, it's been, it was long overdue. I think one of the reasons is because the federal government had classified this on the
sure.
same level as heroin, which it clearly is not. And so now sort of the pendulum is swinging the other way. So we're going to have to see, how people react to this once it's legalized.
Yeah, I saw Cory Booker came out. One of the things he was pushing over the weekend when his announcement was a legalization on the federal level of marijuana. I found that really interesting. But that's a whole other topic. I have another hypothetical for you because you've covered this, and I'm just curious to hear your reaction to this stuff. If it wasn't for the revenue, let's say the state makes no money off marijuana for whatever. Let's wave a magical wand and say $170 million is zero. Okay. Mm-hmm. Do you think we would be doing? Would we be doing this?
Well, of course, the money is a big driver for the government. You know, Illinois government is deep in debt because of pensions and a lot of other spending, and so they need revenue anywhere they can get it. And certainly, Governor Pritzker has introduced, various new proposals for raising money, including legal marijuana and sports betting. Also, I believe will be considered this year. So. They're desperate for money. But otherwise, I think, even apart from the money, as you allude to, I mean, there has been a big shift in public attitudes. I mean, a couple of, public polls in Illinois found about 2/3 of the people supported legalization. So this is something that the public has, their mind has been changed long before the politicians on this.
Yeah, I do think there's been a shift in the culture. I would agree with you. We don't support it. I don't think it's a good idea. But nonetheless, I do recognize that there is clearly a shift from there was, let's say, even 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. I was just reminded that I think there's a movement in Oregon to legalize hallucinogens. Have you heard about that? Is that a slippery slope?
I've heard that. I haven't followed it.
Okay,
I haven't looked
into
it much, but that would seem a bit extreme, I think, to most people. And I would, of course, different states, of course, the West Coast has different attitudes than the Midwest. But, I would say let's, take one step at a time here.
Yeah. I was just curious to hear if you have that. Robert, thanks so much for taking some time this morning. I could talk about this all day. It's one of those interesting topics that it's going to be with us for a while. It'd be interesting to see. So are you gonna make any predictions on whether it passes or not?
Well, I would expect it. I mean, with a Democratic-controlled legislature that supports this and the governor who supports it and even the speaker, apparently.
And they need the money.
I would say that it will pass, but on the other hand, in New Jersey, they also had a similar situation in New Jersey, and it got held up by concerns, primarily a lot from the Black Caucus, about how this was going to affect their community, whether their community was going to be overrun by drugs, or whether it was going to get a cut of the profits or get reinvestment for years, what they say have been years of damage and over-incarceration due to the drug war. So, those issues will definitely be coming up here, too. So those will all have to be addressed.
Thanks to Bob Gilligan and Robert McCappin for their thoughts. Stick around. We'll hear from Deacon John Cook and Monsignor Michael Boland after a short break.
Hi, my name is Sajit Silva, and I work for Catholic Relief Services in Sri Lanka. During this Lent, respond to Pope Francis' invitation to share the journey and stand alongside those bearing the crosses of hunger and poverty by giving to CRS Rice Bowl. 25% of all funds raised in the Diocese of Chicago through CRS Rice Bowl stay in the Archdiocese of Chicago to help people in this community, with the remaining funds serving our brothers and sisters in countries around the world. Visit archchicago.org/CRS to learn more about the people and communities you support through your Lenten gift to CRS Rice Bowl.
Welcome back to Catholic Chicago Week in Review, where we bring you highlights of Archdiocese of Chicago radio programs that can be heard Monday through Friday from 8 to 9 in the morning on WNDZ 750 AM. Albert Anderson is a band director, musician, and an active member of the Knights of Columbus. He was also this Tuesday's guest on our Black Catholic Initiative radio program with Deacon John Cook.
Albert, good morning.
Good morning, sir. How are you doing, brother?
I'm fantastic. Good, and good morning to you. How's everything going?
All doing good. Just sitting here working on some stuff while I was waiting for you.
It sounds like you're working on some stuff. What are you doing there?
Nothing, just some recordings I had to do this morning with Mr. Bob Murphy, and I'm working on the songs before I get there.
Okay, so we won't hold you up too long, Albert. I thank you for coming on this morning. Albert, you initially grew up on the south side of Chicago, right?
Yes, sir.
And what was that upbringing like for you on the south side back then?
Very interesting. My grandmother, black woman by herself, literally adopted me because my mother died when I was 9, and she adopted me. We grew up on 49th and Prairie. So from there, it was 49th and Prairie, Corpus Christi, then Hales Franciscan, then Loyola University.
Did you go to Hales Franciscan?
Yes, sir, class of 71.
Isn't that something? You know, I teach there now.
Oh, way to go. Way to go.
Yeah, and I know you didn't know that because that's something that I just started doing this past September. So you graduated from Hales. Isn't that great?
Yes, sir.
Albert, you might know my uncle, Alfred Cook. Did you know Alfred Cook?
I might have. Was he from Corpus Christi or Hales?
He was at Hales.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
I might have, because it's a lot of gentlemen I knew. I know them by face. I don't remember all the names.
Uh-huh. Well, isn't that something?
Mm-hmm.
And so this love for music that you have, or this, what you're doing, your hobby, your life, how did you begin to get into music?
Well, I found out that when I was a young guy, my mother said when Elvis came on television, I grabbed the broom and started jumping around. A friend of mine who was an old blues guy started me playing.
Uh-huh.
And then I got involved in church because a nun said, I heard you trying to play guitar. And she said, I'd like to, you know, help you with some stuff. I said, okay. Next thing I know, I was playing masses with Sister Ruth. I always remember her.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
So a Sister Ruth got you really involved in playing, and you were playing the guitar?
I was playing guitar. My teacher was a gentleman named Creole Charlie, Mr. Uh-huh. Charles Levy. He was the principal violin player at the old Regal.
Oh, wow.
And that's who actually taught me professionally about playing.
Have you heard that the musician Kanye West, I believe it is, he's mm-hmm. going to renovate the Regal?
Oh, God, that'll be beautiful.
Yeah, he's actually him and Kim Kardashian, of course, that's his wife.
Oh, God.
You know, they're going to be moving back to Chicago if they're not here already, but he is supposedly going to renovate the Regal. He may have bought it. In fact, I'm sure he did. He bought it, and he's going to renovate it.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, maybe you can get back over there.
Oh, God, I'd love to. I was supposed to play there once with the big band that I played with for 30 years, and we never did get the gig because they had problems with the renovations at that time. So
uh-huh.
they canceled it. But it was beautiful even then.
And,
really pretty.
And you also now, you got a lovely wife. You've been married or will be 45 years, right?
June 1st, yeah.
Isn't
I don't know
that
how
something?
She put up with me that long.
Well, I guess she lets you play your music, and maybe that keeps you away. I don't know. How does that work? Why don't you give us some advice?
Well, the best thing I can tell you, sometimes it's nice to be separated just for a minute, you know, and I don't mean separated, leaving. I mean just doing what you like doing.
I got you.
If you love what you're doing, and she knows that, it's like I said, it's been 45 years. I've had a job over the years. I worked a job. I played music. I worked a job. I did this. I did real estate. I played music. Did insurance. I played music. And like I tell everybody, for 30 years, I played big band jazz, Duke Ellington, Count Basie, Glenn Miller. Started playing blues. Next thing I know, I was playing in Europe and Canada. It was fun.
That is so awesome. Now, you said it was fun, so you're not doing that kind of travel anymore.
Oh, God, no. I still, sometimes I'll go and play different places, but I don't travel like that, mainly because of my health. I got sick about 2012-13,
mm-hmm.
so I had to cut back on that part. But now I'm playing more, so I'm actually, that's why I'm working on a CD, so I can actually start playing out more.
Yeah, you know, and I recall you being ill some years ago, because mm-hmm. You and I met originally at the Bishop James P. Like Image Awards.
Yes, Ladies Guild of Peter Claver, 181 Council.
Yeah.
And they are the reason that I'm still playing now.
So that's the Knights of Peter Claver, Ladies Auxiliary.
Yes, Ladies Auxiliary.
Right. And you've been playing there for how long now?
Oh, God. I think it's been almost 20 years.
Yeah.
Because we're getting, this summer, we're going to play their 25th anniversary, so I think it's been quite a while.
That is a long time, and I know that event that is well attended, they usually have anywhere from 300 to 500 people there.
Yes.
And you bring along with you the band, which is pronounced Ajana? Ajana?
Ajana, the Chicago band.
Uh-huh. And so, mm-hmm. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that's the main name that I've used for years.
How did you come up with that name?
That's a combination of my name and my wife's name. A friend of mine, when I first met my wife, said, oh, that's pretty. I said, what's that? Your names match up perfectly. A-J-A-N-A. Albert James Andrea N. Anderson. I went, oh, that's nice. Ajana. When I did my first record, the young lady at the radio studio said, oh, that's so pretty. I said, yeah, it's pronounced. She said, Ajana. I said, yeah, that's it. I changed it. I said, perfect. Sounds beautiful.
Hey, I think it's a great name. It's very catchy.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thanks to Deacon John and Albert Anderson for joining us this week. Next up was our Voice of Charity program. Catholic Charities President Monsignor Michael Boland and his guests talked about the great ways parishes partner and get involved with Catholic Charities.
Parishes are often the catalyst that brings new Catholic Charities programs into their communities, articulating neighborhood needs and helping us to establish new services. Catholic Charities has 7 regional offices in Cook and Lake counties that provide volunteer opportunities for parish groups, help parish congregations learn about our services and needs, and work to help us to establish and operate community-based food pantries. And in so many ways that these are important for us is to make sure that these services are close to where our clients are. And so we have these 7 major presences in the different communities, and they're really there to help us to be able to be close to where the parishes are, our volunteers are, and also the needs are of those whom we are trying to serve. For more than a decade, you know, our board of directors created the parish outreach program, and has helped us to build bridges between parishes and Catholic Charities. This committee of parish partners was formed to further the goals of the programs, like conducting food, clothing, diaper, coat, school supplies, toy drives, and a host of many other things to really help us to be able to improve the quality of life of those that we serve. Adopting various programs such as anti-violence initiatives, senior centers, and veteran services are only a few of the things, many things that the parishes have done with us and for us. I'm very grateful this morning. We're joined first by Mike Waters, who is our Northwest Regional Director, and Sue Geegan, who is the Parish Ambassador for the Northwest Region. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mike and Sue. How are you?
Good morning.
I'm doing well. Thanks for having us on.
Good. Thank you very much for taking time. I know that what probably first we want to do is just maybe, Mike, you could tell us a little bit about how would you help us, the people who are listening, where is, we're talking about the Northwest community, maybe you could give us an idea where that is.
Yes, our office is in Des Plaines, and from that office we serve the north and northwest suburbs. And for me, a big part of my job as the regional director for the northwest suburbs is to build and nurture relationships with parishes in that region. So I help bring parishes to the table as members of the parish outreach committee that you mentioned in your introduction, and serve as their liaison to Catholic Charities.
Okay, that's great. And how do parishes get involved?
They can get involved in a couple of ways. First, through the Parish Outreach Committee and through their relationships with Catholic Charities, they learn about the many programs and services that we offer and share that information with their parishes. They also partner with us on initiatives to help those in need. And that support means so much to us and our clients, and it's a big reason why we're able to help as many people as we do.
That's great. And what are some of the benefits you see from a partnership, like from the parish side and then also from the charity side?
Well, for one thing, for parishes and their members, it's an opportunity to put their faith into action. to fulfill the gospel mission to serve God's poor. Our volunteers and those who work with us on projects here find it to be a very fulfilling experience, and I think they really enjoy it. Also, the more aware the parishioners are of the services we offer, the more likely it is that they'll be able to come to us for help if they need it. Many of our clients are referred to us by pastors or representatives on the parish outreach committee, and we do everything we can to help them.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Sue, how are you doing today?
I'm doing wonderful. Thank you.
Well, it's great to have you on the radio today, and just thank you for all that you do for us out there in the northwest suburbs and beyond. I'm very grateful. Maybe you could talk to us a little about the, I know that you are the parish ambassador out there. Maybe you could talk about what that means for you and what that role is.
Sure. I think it starts back with my familiarity years ago. I knew the name Catholic Charities, but I had no idea the extent of all the things that Catholic Charities does. And when I first joined the staff, I'm on staff at Holy Family Parish in Inverness. I began to learn more and more because I was working with people on the fringes. And Catholic Charities was so helpful in not just offering assistance and guidance, but connecting me with resources within Catholic Charities and with other local agencies. And I think because of my experience going from just recognizing the name to then growing to a much fuller understanding of what Catholic Charities actually does, it compelled me to make sure that other parishes knew the breadth of programs that Catholic Charities offered. And that role of parish ambassador allows me to do just that. And it develops relationships, peer relationships within the parishes, which is very important.
A reminder that you can learn more about all the services offered by Catholic Charities and how you can help by visiting catholiccharities.net. Next up, Built on the Rock and Mission Matters. Back after a short break.
Who am I? What does it mean to love? Why was I created? We'll address all of these great questions and more at Echo Chicago this June. Hello, I'm Dawn Fitzpatrick from Respect Life Ministries for the Archdiocese of Chicago. Echo Chicago is a Theology of the Body summer camp for teens and young adults. The Archdiocese is partnering with Dumox Ministries to present a week of prayer, fun, and immersion in the teachings of St. Pope John Paul II. This exciting camp will take place at St. Xavier University in Chicago, June 14th to the 20th. Registration's now open. Go to respectlifechicago.org or call 312-534-5355 for more information. That's respectlifechicago.org or call 312-534-5355. Early bird pricing is available until May 1st. All of us feel an echo in our heart to explore God's original creation and his true purpose for us. Join us in June for Echo Chicago.
Welcome back to Catholic Chicago Week in Review on Relevant Radio 950 and 930 AM. I'm Jim Dish of the Archdiocese of Chicago's Radio TV office with highlights of our local Catholic radio programs that can be heard Monday through Friday from 8 to 9 in the morning on 750 AM. Father Brito Birchmans and Sandy Labouvi co-host Built on the Rock, a program that helps listeners build their marriages and romantic relationships on the rock that is Christ. Let's listen in on some of this week's conversation.
We were discussing the story of Bob and Mary Plone, which was the couple that we had interviewed last month. So the baby was born very small, very, very small, and the nurses were very impressed with the faith that Bob and Mary had expressed throughout the pregnancy. And Mary had talked about how once that baby was born, things shifted from those earlier thoughts of why did this happen to us and how are we going to get through this to thoughts of how were we the ones chosen to witness this and to see this miracle and how blessed we were. So it's just interesting to see that perspective change from something that they thought was maybe almost even unmanageable or extremely scary to what a miracle God worked through this.
In fact, the later part of the story told us how it was a miracle, and we will talk about it in our next show. But their testimony really triggered something in us. You know, we usually talk about relationships and we talk about how to make the marriage stronger, but having a child is such a big part of a marriage, especially in a Catholic marriage. And their example wanted us to go in a different direction. So we would like to dedicate this show to talk about life, about our attitude towards life, or what we call pro-life. And it is so Catholic. And I think especially at this juncture in the history of our country and of the world, and I think this is a very important topic. You know, just the other day in Ohio, the governor signed a bill, you know, restricting abortions. And then you have New York that a few weeks ago, months ago, passed a bill, you know, to make abortion available even more, you know. And in Illinois, they were considering similar bills. So on the one side, there is a movement towards being more pro-life, but there is a movement towards being so pro-abortion. So I think it is important to talk about that. And we have never done that on the show, and I thought it would be good. Mm-hmm. So first of all, I want to say, at the basis of our teaching on our approach to life is this fundamental belief that God and God alone is the author of life. And we believe that. And that frames everything else. And everything else flows from that point. And so whenever we choose to play God, then we get into trouble. Instead of allowing God to play his ultimate role as the author of life. And here is where I think abortion or even all other problems with life originate from refusing to accept God as the author of life. And the basic scripture for me, for our whole attitude towards life, is from Book of Jeremiah. Before you were born, I knew you. In your mother's womb, I formed you. And this is exactly what God says. In the Catholic teaching, we believe that at the moment when the ovum and the sperm meet and the egg is fertilized, God infuses the immortal soul. And we believe from there, it is a person. And I would say that even science tells us it is true.
Yeah, at that very moment of fertilization, your baby's genetic makeup is complete, exactly, including its sex. At that very moment, that is determined.
Yes.
Yeah, so you brought up the Catholic Church's teaching, and I think it might be good actually to just review specifically for our listeners what the Catholic Church's teaching on abortion is. So we can look to our catechism for that information, and I'll just read specifically what the Church says about that matter. So from number 2270, it says that human life must be respected and protected absolutely from the moment of conception. From the first moment of his existence, a human being must be recognized as having the rights of a person, among which is the inviolable right of every innocent being to life.
It is an inviolable right because once you deny that right, all of the rights are irrelevant.
Exactly, exactly. So the second teaching would be from number 2271. It says, the Catechism says that since the first century, the Church has affirmed the moral evil of every procured abortion. This teaching has not changed and remains unchangeable. Direct abortion, that is to say, abortion willed either as an end or means, is gravely contrary to the moral law.
See, this is, you know, the judge is very clear, either as an end or as a means. What is the means? For example, in vitro fertilization, one of the problems is that they only take one of the embryos and some of the other embryos are discarded. Mm. And that is a problem. It becomes a means, do you know? Mm-hmm. Or to have embryos for the sake of stem cells. Again, it is as a means. Mm-hmm. Because a person cannot be used as a means. Mm. A person is a value, an end to themselves. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that is the Church's teaching.
The Church also talks about abortion or the crime against human life with strict penalties. It does say in number 2272, formal cooperation in an abortion constitutes a grave offense.
Exactly, exactly. I don't think the Church has ever been, you know, less clear about it.
Right.
But unfortunately, I think living in a society that doesn't believe in it, especially I'm worried about our younger people who get caught up in this war of words, I can say, you know, because I think it is all semantics. And we as pro-life people, we say we are pro-life, and they will never say we are pro-death.
Right.
They will say pro-choice.
Right.
You see, they emphasize the woman, and yet they forget about the child.
Right. And that's the amazing thing when I think about it, is all of this, you know, this should be the right of the woman. The woman has a right to a choice. But that thinking seems to stop when you think about that baby inside of the woman.
Exactly. And you know, people make all sorts of arguments about, oh, you know, it is only a mass of cells. It is not this, it is not that. But if you really think about it, you know, has a woman ever given birth to a horse? Woman has always given birth to a child. Maybe a child with certain challenges, a child with certain defects or handicaps. It's always a child.
Yeah. So, Father, in preparation for this show, I actually had looked into some of the fetal development stages, just for my own benefit. And we don't need to read through all of that now. I think many people are aware of these things. But even within 3 weeks, just to point out, the baby's first nerve cells have already formed. And another statistic that was just being a mother and having had children in my womb, it really touched me, that in month one, the tiny heart tube of that embryo will beat 65 times a minute.
Mm.
Already in month one, its heart is beating. That's powerful.
Yes.
And then it goes on. You can look that up and see the development stages over the course of the months. And one thing that is just glaringly obvious is that from the very beginning, this is a human. This is a human who is developing and growing. Surely it's not independent, obviously. That's why God designed this period in the mother's womb. But you cannot deny that that is a human being.
I know. But there is hope, because I think we have seen some changes, you know, that the country as a whole, maybe it is becoming more pro-life, but also some parts of the country are becoming more pro-abortion.
Always good to hear from Father Brito and Sandy. Now to Megan Mio, Mission Education and Appeals Coordinator, who visits with Jorge Rivera about developing a culture of mission.
Good morning, Jorge, and welcome.
Good morning, Megan.
It's so wonderful to have you.
I'm excited to be here.
It's great that you're working in mission. So some of my listeners might just recognize your name and voice, Jorge. Jorge ministered in the Archdiocese of Chicago as a coordinator for Hispanic Young Adult Ministry, and more recently he served as director of the Office of Hispanic Ministry in the Diocese of Joliet. So, welcome back, and thank you for your many years of ministry and mission in and around the Chicago area. But it's great that Jorge is now working on mission work and missionary discipleship, building connections and mission. But for those of you listeners who don't know Jorge, we thought we'd just ask and get things started by asking Jorge, tell us a little bit about your background.
Sure, definitely. Well, I can begin by saying that I've been raised here in the city of Chicago since an early age. My parents brought me from Puerto Rico. And living here in Chicago, I did my studies here in Chicago. I worked previously, before engaging in ministry, I was an insurance agent.
Oh, my
Go figure,
goodness.
Huh?
A whole different world, right?
And in seeking to work in the church, I've always been involved in some type of volunteer ministry in my local parish. And when the opportunity came and I was hired here in the Archdiocese of Chicago, it was an exciting time for me. It was like fulfilling a sort of mission for me at an early age, not understanding it, but fulfilling that calling of engaging and somehow be part of that evangelization in the community process. No, and so I did 18 years here in the Archdiocese of Chicago. And then 5.5 years in the Diocese of Joliet. I always wanted to stay in the Midwest, and I'm so glad it happened in that manner.
Excellent. Oh, so wonderful. So it sounds like that you had, it was a journey that eventually led you to ministry. It wasn't an immediate, like you said, you didn't recognize the call maybe right away.
Mm-hmm.
But you had those gifts, and you had that desire.
Oh, my goodness. As long as I can remember being... As I said, engaged in ministry somehow, but like always, as a young kid, as an altar boy, and then, but my passion was through music, interestingly enough, and I have relatives that were, I have an uncle that's a deacon in Puerto Rico, and for some reason, he always saw a vocation, priestly vocation. I mean, it never happened, but I have this fond passion for those that fulfill their calling as a priest, and I advocate for that, even though I'm not, but I advocate, sure, and priests. I seem to enjoy these young men that and women that enter into religious life. It's beautiful.
Mm. Well, that's an invitation that you received from your uncle.
Exactly.
it came true. I mean, the vocation to serving the church, to ministry.
Yes, in the broader sense. Doing it in a different manner, but still serving and specifically now that making this transition of the Diocese of Joliet and after working at that time as a director of Hispanic ministry, it gave me a wide sense of what was what's taking place over the years in this accompaniment with the Latino community, and be able to create a network here in the Midwest.
Right. Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about your experience in ministry. I mentioned in the introduction that you did work in the Archdiocese of Chicago. You were working in young adult Hispanic ministry, and then in Joliet Hispanic ministry more broadly with all ages, presumably.
Yes.
And you've built a network from that, which I'm sure is very valuable. We'll talk more about that in your work with Mary Knoll. So what kinds of experiences? You mentioned music as well as something that's been important to you. How have these experiences developed over the years?
I have to say that while working in the Archdiocese of Chicago, I started out as coordinator of Hispanic ministry for Vicariate 2.
Okay.
Yeah, so it was an interesting journey. I had, at that time, about 26 parishes that had Hispanic ministry in that specific sector of the diocese. And but my connections seemed to, my door openers always seemed to be with the young community. And a way for me to connect with them, I always had to begin somehow. I began to carry my guitar around. So I started visiting these young adult groups that were active, at mainly, predominantly a first-generation immigrant population. I mean, I'm talking back in late 90s.
Sure.
As a matter of fact, when I start looking back, I feel, oh, my goodness, my age is creeping up. But with the young people, it became an instant connection in sharing with them and connecting with them and accompanying what they were already doing.
Right.
So it when I transitioned from coordinator of Hispanic ministry for the Vicariate, and I was asked to do full-time young adult, Latino young adult ministry. Again, it was like already a network already on the works.
Yeah.
And
easy transition.
And I was able to be able to spread that with the other vicariates and established a what we call in Spanish una red, which is the network, with leaderships representative of parishes in each of the vicariates. And we were able to develop four encuentros that were very significant. And in each encuentro, one of my gifts back to the young population was through music. So I would write songs that would become the theme of each encuentro. And those theme songs, then later on, I compiled them and developed a CD, music, that was disseminated amongst the Latino young people, and I think if anything, if they didn't remember my name, they would remember the song that was the thing.
And we close with a reminder that you can listen to all our local Catholic radio programs live or at your convenience by going to archchicago.org and clicking on the radio TV stamp. That's archchicago.org. Thanks for listening to us every Saturday morning here on Relevant Radio 950 and 930 AM. I'm Jim Dish for Catholic Chicago Week in Review, wishing all our listeners and your families a blessed Easter season.
Join us every Saturday morning for Catholic Chicago Week in Review. You can stream our programs live or listen to past programs by visiting our website, archchicago.org, and clicking on Radio TV. And please connect with Catholic Chicago on social media.